Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and thanks for tuning in to Inside Scoop Live. I'm your host, Juanita Watson, and today on the program, I'll be talking with Michael Shearer, author of the new novel, Island Life. After stints as a manual laborer, dishwasher, bartender, restaurant manager, commercial photographer, magazine editor, and public relations executive, Michael Shearer decided that life should imitate art, and he's now a freelance writer like his mystery series protagonist. He's published 5 novels in the Emerson Ward Mystery Series. They are An Option on Death, Little Use for Death, Death Came Dressed in White, A Forever Death, and Death is No Bargain. His new novel, which just came out, is titled Island Life and is a standalone thriller about an ordinary suburban father's race to find out what happened to his missing wife before he loses his children, his freedom, and the possibility of his life. And you can find out more about this new novel and Michael Shearer at islandlife-thenovel.com. And I'm just so pleased to have Michael on the phone today. Welcome to the program, Michael.
Well, thanks, Juanita. It's so nice to be here.
Yes. Well, congratulations. I have to say, this is quite an accomplishment. This is your 6th book to date.
That's right.
Yeah. And, you know, I first became, interested in your work through your Emerson Ward series, and I know that you and I dialogued, I think it was last year on that. So why did you take a departure from that series?
I had so much fun with that character, but the idea for Island Life I've had since, almost 15 years, I think. It was early 90s when this thought popped into my head of how you live without someone after 20 years. And it kind of percolated, if you will, in my head, because the thought was I wanted to do a mainstream novel. I think we all have these aspirations to be, to be literary novelists at one point or another, those of us in the mystery genre, and it's kind of funny because mystery has really become kind of a mainstream genre.
Uh-huh.
But, I had this idea of, I want to do this mainstream book about relationships and about, this man who faces crises of How do you deal with losing someone or someone who's been in your life for that long, no longer being there, and then having to raise a family by yourself? And the idea just kind of, as I say, percolated. It sat in the back of my head for a long time because I didn't feel ready to write it, is really what it came down to. And when I finally did feel ready to write it, I realized that one of the problems that I have with mainstream, a lot of mainstream novels and a lot of literary fiction, is that it doesn't tell a story. It is about relationships. A lot of these books are about relationships, and they're wonderfully written. I love some of the books I've read. I mean, Margaret Atkins is a great example of someone whose writing is absolutely beautiful, but sometimes you finish the book and you go, what was that about? I like to tell stories, is what I realized. And so I felt that to do this story justice, I needed to have more going on than simply the family relationships. And I felt, well, what better than to throw this guy into the middle of a mystery, which kind of, puts pressure on him, even more pressure than he would have by simply just, someone not being in his life for a while. I mean, that happens to people every day. I mean, parents get divorced, one parent or the other has to start raising family by themselves. So I felt that, let's put more pressure on the guy and put him into a mystery and increase some of those pressures.
Mm-hmm. It's a very interesting and unique book. You really did not follow the sort of formulaic pattern of this genre, and I'm glad that you really are speaking to that because it really shows up in your writing.
Well, I think a lot of people, they expect to see a body on page one of a mystery. And my feeling was that because this book is so much about relationships and about the family, that I wanted to introduce the mystery in a much more slow and leisurely fashion because I wanted to give more story, more backstory about this man and his relationship with the wife who's disappeared and his children.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is a very leisurely start, and a lot of people have noticed that, but in reviews I've gotten, people say, gosh, it starts slow, but, it really started handy.
Yeah.
So I had fun with it that way because, I wanted to lead the reader into the relationships and has, and then into the mystery that puts a lot of pressure on
you. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you are actually really grappling with this whole idea of single fatherhood in this book, and you really turn the stereotypes upside down. And I know that was kind of a conscious decision for you. So I'd like to maybe hear a little bit more about Jack Holm, your lead character in this book, and really this issue that you wanted to spotlight for him.
Well, one of the things that, I did take on was the idea of a man heading a household. And I think that, we've seen in the course of the last 30 years an enormous growth in the number of single father households. I think it's 500% growth or something like that. There are 2.5 million single fathers out there raising families.
It's amazing.
And we still have these traditional ideas about male and female, gender roles, especially when it comes to family and raising kids. And I think that males, men have kind of gotten short shrift, if you will, in the media.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at for example, the sitcoms on TV, I think that, that kind of gives you a good example of how men are often portrayed in media as, hey, we're a little bit clueless. We don't really understand, the stuff about relationships and kids, they're a real mystery to us, and certainly, our wives are a mystery to us. Gosh, anything domestic, forget it. We don't know.
Right.
That. And I thought, well, wait a minute. I've been, I actually was married to a flight attendant
for
20 plus years,
mm-hmm.
and so I was a single parent half the time. And that was partly also a conscious decision on my part when I eventually stopped doing a 9-to-5 job and gave up my career to become a freelancer. It was a conscious decision to say, I want to spend more time with my kids.
Mm.
The kind of time that I didn't have with my father, because he was a traditional dad. He went to the office every day, and, so we didn't see that much of him. And I wanted to take a more active role in my kids' lives. And as I approached this book, I thought, I want to do the same thing. I want to talk about those challenges of being a single father without the kind of support network that women often have as, either a traditional family of married spouses, or even, in a family where a woman is divorced and heads the family as a single woman. They often have a greater support network than men do. And as I say, I think that the media sometimes unfairly portray men as kind of clueless when it comes to, their domestic abilities.
Why did you do that?
One of the things I wanted to take on was that whole notion of, gosh, maybe we don't approach parenthood the same way as women do, but we can do as good a job.
Mm-hmm, good point.
In other ways, because we bring other strengths to that relationship with our kids. And so that was a real challenge, was to show Jack as the kind of guy who is very involved in his kids' lives, even though, he is also a breadwinner. But, as in many families today, both he and his wife were earners, the dual income household kind of thing. But when his wife disappears, obviously he has to take on more of the roles. He has to be not only father, but he has to be mother as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where these relationships with his kids come in, because, he had to build those relationships in order to help maintain them. And, of course, with all the challenges that are thrown on him, they strain those relationships. And I think it's interesting to watch how he deals with that.
Yes, very interesting. So let's get into the story. Tell us about Island Life.
The story is really about this man, Jack, who's got two kids. He's got a daughter who's 15, and teenagers can be tough, especially young girls.
Mm-hmm.
They're going through puberty and becoming young adults. And he's got a 10-year-old son. And his wife disappears one day. He thinks she's gone shopping. And when she doesn't come back, because she's a flight attendant, he thinks maybe she's picked up a trip. And his kids, are kind of used to this, that she's gone 3 days at a time, off to some exotic destination. So they're not concerned at first, but they are, kind of underlying, there's this underlying question of, where's mom? And after 3 days, he realizes she's not on a trip.
Right.
But, part of the reason he hasn't been as concerned as he might is because he and his wife have been having some marital difficulties. They've been going through a rough spot in their marriage. And so he feels both relief and guilt at the same time that he's not more concerned. He feels guilty that he's not more concerned, but he also feels relief that he's got this break, that his wife is gone and he kind of can think. But after 3 days, she's not home. He obviously begins to worry. And after calling, family, friends to see if she may have been doing the same thing, going off, and taking some time to think about their relationship and work on that, nobody's seen her. So he goes to the police. And, of course, as is often the case, the police immediately focus their suspicions on Jack and start an investigation into what might have happened to her. They immediately suspect foul play.
Mm-hmm.
And as it turns out, she's found a week later, raped and strangled in a shallow grave, and Jack is arrested for her murder.
Mm-hmm.
So now he faces the pressure of you know, if he's arrested and put in jail, then his kids go to foster care. He may end up losing them permanently. Of course, he may end up in jail permanently, you know, based on the outcome of the trial. And all of this time, of course, unbeknownst to him, but there's sort of hints of it, somebody's been stalking his family, and he doesn't know who or why. And he realizes that the evidence, again, is so overwhelming that the police obviously are not going to focus on anyone else. So if he doesn't do anything to find out what happened to his wife, then he's going to lose everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so that puts sort of increasing pressure on him as the book goes along to figure out what happened to his wife and figure out what's going on with his family.
Yeah, yeah. And then there's lots of twists and turns on that road.
A few twists and turns along the road.
So did you kind of base this on any real life stories? I mean, as I'm listening to you, it sounds like maybe a story I might hear on the evening news, you know? Like, was there any inspiration in any of that?
Certainly you take, I think you take bits and pieces from real life all the time. I think authors do that. They'll
yeah.
read a newspaper article and go, gee, of course, you know, that's sort of the Law and Order school of plotting is ripped from the headlines.
Mm.
But we do. I mean, we obviously take things that we see or things that have happened to us personally. You can grab experiences from everywhere, I think, and put it into a pot and make a wonderful stew out of it. Yes, there are certain pieces that are true to life. There was, in the community where I live, there was a murder about 10 years ago, which was similar to this one, but the motivation and everything was way different. So I kind of borrowed from that a little bit just as inspiration as opposed to, you know, here's what actually happened. But yeah, as you say, I mean, you find pieces of things from real life, from your own life, that you use as inspiration in books like this.
Sure. I think it was a really interesting choice, Michael, to reveal Jack's relationship with his wife through therapy sessions. And I'd like to know why you decided to do this, and then if you could maybe tell listeners more about that aspect of your writing.
Well, I think, as I mentioned earlier, one of the things that I wanted to take on was this issue of single fatherhood. And I wanted to do a couple of things with Jack himself. One, I wanted to make him a sympathetic character. I wanted readers, obviously, to like him, to understand that here is a man who is doing his best and who does have a pretty good relationship with his kids and who has really taken on some non-traditional roles in, you know, as a parent. But I also wanted the reader to look at Jack and wonder. I wanted readers to, as Jack himself does, suspect that he may be capable of killing his wife, because he is in a rough patch marriage. I wanted people to suspect that, you know, this may be possible for him. And in fact, the evidence is so overwhelming that Jack himself begins to believe he may have done it.
Oh, my God.
In some kind of blackout.
Yeah.
You know, that maybe he actually did it. But I also realized that if I took that stance and carried it a little too far, then readers were not going to sympathize with Jack or empathize with him. And I realized that it wasn't fair at all to his wife to kind of present, you know, the story only from Jack's perspective. And because the novel is from first-person perspective, that's the only voice we hear. We hear Jack's.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the only, you know, point of view we see is through Jack's eyes. And I felt that the only fair way to present his relationship with his wife was to do backstory. But again, I couldn't do it simply from Jack's point of view. Because it's presented as, you know, his story.
Very biased, yeah.
Very biased.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt, well, maybe I can tell that part of the story. I can tell some of the backstory through, you know, this exchange, if you will, with a therapist. And it really intrigued me of, okay, here's how I can get at his relationship with his wife by having him air his marital difficulties with a therapist. And that way, the reader can not only understand Jack's point of view, but he can also understand what it was about the relationship that made, you know, the present time very rocky for him and his wife. And I felt that that was a much more fair way of presenting his relationship with his wife.
Yeah, I think it's great. It really, really adds to this story. So how does Jack's relationship with his children change throughout this whole process? I mean, that's a big shift.
I think that, one, he grows closer to them as a result of all of this. Two, I think that he also exposes his vulnerabilities to them. They see that, you know, he's not just a dad. He is, you know, a human being, a man with flaws, a guy who's doing his best but makes mistakes. You know, he does some really dumb things, you know, as a clueless guy would. But on the other hand, he does it with the best of intentions. And he does these things, you know, with his family in mind, and yet he's, you know, he kind of forgets parts of what's important. So, I think that helps his children understand, you know, that he can be a good parent and, you know, make mistakes at the same time, that he can be a flawed human being and still be a good dad. So I think that you know, a lot of it is kind of that normal growth that parents have, you know, in their relationship with their kids. You know, as their kids grow, you know, it's like we always used to hear when we were parenting, advice from outside is like, it's only a phase.
Right.
But it's always a phase.
Right, there's always a phase
there's
going
always
on.
A phase. You know, don't worry about it. They'll grow out of it. But then there'll be something else, you know. So.
Right. Well, I was wondering if you had children and if you, you know, were reflecting back when you were writing this story and his dynamic with the children, if any of your experience.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, we do borrow heavily from personal experience as authors. And yeah, I've got four kids. Three kids and a stepdaughter. So it's been great fun spending time with my children.
Sure.
And watching them grow. And, of course, you think of all the things that you've done over the course of raising your kids, all the mistakes you've made, but all of the, you know, the fun times and the good things you've done as well.
Sure. I wonder if becoming a single father would really bring out talents or parenting skills for a man that may just stay under the surface in the more traditional family role. Of a two-parent family?
I think it's inevitable. I think that there have been examples of that in media too. I mean, you look at a movie like Mrs. Doubtfire. I mean, there's a guy who kind of rose to the occasion. He found a lot of skills that he didn't have in his relationship with his wife when he was on his own. So I think that's a pretty
good example. Absolutely. So what do you appreciate most about Jack Holm?
Yeah, I think I appreciate his persistence and his courage. The fun thing for me about writing mysteries is that I can put myself into the shoes of a character that I am not in real life.
Mm-hmm.
I'm certainly not nearly as courageous as Jack Holm, nor my series protagonist, Emerson Ward. These are guys who face danger head on, while they blink. They, stand their ground. And, gosh, I turned tail and run like heck. that they face some very scary situations, and I admire their courage. And I think that's the most fun for me is to be, a superhero through an alter ego.
Right. Yeah, you must have a great time writing these books.
Oh, they're a lot of fun to write.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Are you looking for new ways to promote your book? Why not consider being interviewed live? With the huge impact internet radio as well as podcasting is making in our society, your voice can now be heard worldwide. Let Juanita at Inside Scoop Live create the necessary steps for you. You will not only receive a web page of your own, but your interview will be available for MP3 download and RSS feed. As well, your interview will be posted on venues such as iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, Podcast Alley, and the Inside Scoop Live blog. Go to InsideScoopLive.com today for more information.
Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Just to remind you, I'm talking today with Michael Shearer, author of Island Life. You can find out more about Michael through his website, islandlife-thenovel.com.
I think the hardest part about them is trying to come up with something new.
That's true. That's
And also coming up with a plot that makes sense.
Well, how do you come up with your plots?
You let things kind of rattle around in your brain long enough, and eventually a story will come out.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of funny. I just Island Life came out, and about 6 weeks later, just a couple of weeks ago, I finished a brand new manuscript.
Oh, okay.
And I was at a mystery conference in Denver, West Coast Crime, and I'm sure a lot of mystery readers will recognize that, a big fan convention. Yeah, about a month ago in Denver, and moderated a panel on exactly that topic, where ideas come from. Mm-hmm. And I had the great fortune of moderating a panel of four lovely, very witty, very intelligent women writers who are terrific at what they do. And I thought, well, I'll give them kind of an analogy to run with and see what they do with it. I liken the process to being pregnant. You have this germ of an idea, it slowly gestates and kind of build on it, and it grows, and finally you come up with this book. And the problem is that once you're done with the book, you get postpartum depression.
Yeah, that's great.
Well, I finished a manuscript a couple of weeks ago, and I'm like, gosh, it's the first time in over a year that I haven't had anything to work on. And I'm going crazy. I'm going, I got to work on something, but I don't have a plot yet for another book.
Oh,
it really is a matter of starting with a germ of an idea and just building on it by asking what if questions. As I say, the premise for Island Life was, how do you live without someone after 20 years?
Mm-hmm.
And it just goes from there. You start saying, well, okay, who is this guy? What circumstances would lead him to be without someone after 20 years? And, what's going to make an interesting story?
Mm-hmm.
And it just takes time.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So where do you think your next inspiration might come from? Are you tossing around any ideas?
Well, I finished a sixth Emerson Ward novel, which I hope will come out soon.
Mm-hmm.
And the book I just finished is the first in a brand new series set here in Seattle, which is where I now live. And it's about a man who's kind of lost everything and is trying to hide from society and gets thrown into a situation that he has to deal with. Otherwise, he stands to lose. He thought he lost it all. He could stand to lose even more.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's, I think that's what's interesting for readers, is seeing how people react under those kinds of circumstances. And I had great fun with it. The premise was to take a guy and who does something totally unusual, and that is he works at night.
Mm-hmm.
And not only does he work at night, I mean, there are a lot of people that do that. Most people who do are, environments like, hospitals, offices and things like that, or pilots, firefighters, so forth. Most of them are indoors. I mean, they're confined to their workplace. This guy delivers newspapers. So he's out and about. He's on the streets. He sees the stuff that happens.
Yeah. Oh, that sounds very interesting.
So I had a lot of fun with it.
Oh, yeah. It sounds to me like there's a common theme of your main characters that really are about inner strength.
I think that's true, I think that's true of the genre in general, that mysteries, thrillers, suspense novels all have that in common of, it's kind of the hero's journey.
Mm.
And it's that story arc of taking this person, whatever their circumstance, saying, well, how do these circumstances shape that person, and how do they react to those circumstances in a way that, takes them, to some sort of conclusion.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, did you typically write in the mystery genre, obviously. Was writing in the thriller, more the thriller suspense, was it any different for you?
It is very different. As a matter of fact, that's the challenge that I faced in the book I just finished. A thriller, by definition, is something that keeps you on the edge of your seat, and it does it in a very interesting way. First of all, it continues to build tension throughout the book. The tension throughout the book just is a crescendo from, down low all the way to up high, and it's resolved, whatever it is. And the way authors do that is by letting readers know what the bad guys are up to before the protagonist knows.
Mm.
So the reader anticipates what may happen, and that builds tension. You can't do that from a first-person point of view. And I generally write from first-person point of view.
Yeah.
And if you think about the thriller, thrillers are written from an omniscient or a third, a person's point of view, because that way the author can get into the heads of all kinds of different characters and tell the story from, you know, not only the perspective of the protagonist, but also the perspective of the bad guys, of the villains.
How did you tackle that challenge then?
It was difficult.
Yeah.
It was difficult. And I'm not sure that I've succeeded entirely, but I think, like Island Life, it does succeed on its own merits. You feel the tension build because enough things start happening to the character that even from the first-person point of view, even though the reader doesn't know exactly what's happening outside of that point of view, it is happening to the protagonist, and the reader sees how it increases the tension in his own life, the suspense in his own life, and how is he going to deal with it. It's an interesting challenge, and I'm not sure that I have succeeded entirely, but I'm very happy with it. As a matter of fact, I think it came out pretty well, yeah.
I think that Island Life has quite a fast pace, and, you know, you're taking the whole scene from Seattle to Las Vegas, and there's some pretty shady characters involved, and so, you know, there is quite a lot of suspense in it. Twists and turns.
It's a lot of fun to try and, you know, build that suspense and build that tension. Okay, what can I pile on? What can I pile on now that still will be credible, but, you know, we'll build the tension even more.
So tell us, for any writers out there that may be, you know, in the middle of writing their own book, what advice would you give to them, this being your sixth book, for really following their dreams and getting their books out there?
It's a matter of persistence. You bang on the door long enough, if you've got enough talent, then that door should open. You know, a lot of it is being in the right place at the right time. My first book came in 1988, so I've had, it's taken me a long time to actually publish six books, but it's been, you know, kind of a wonderful career for me.
Yeah.
But I think it really is about serendipity. It's about being in the right place at the right time. At the Left Coast Crime Conference in Denver, the guest of honor was Stephen White.
Oh, wow.
Who was a New York Times best-selling author, fabulous writer, and he was interviewed by Elaine Vietz on the last day of the conference on Sunday, as a kind of tradition. And she asked him, you know, how he became a best-selling author, and he said, you know, it's an interesting story. My first book came out in a hardcover, and my publisher did about 12,000 copies. It did pretty well, and gosh, I was really happy with that. And they bought my second book, and they printed more copies of that, and it's selling even better than the first one. And I thought, hey, this is progress. This is pretty good. And the first book came out in paperback, and the second book, it was time for it to come out in paperback. And he said, when it was time for it to come out, the lead title, the publisher's lead title that month, for some reason, got messed up at the printer, and so they had no lead title. And they sat around in an editorial meeting, he said, and it was time to go to lunch, and about 3 minutes before lunch, somebody brought up, you know, the question again. Okay, guy, what are we going to do about lead title? And one of the editors said, well, what about White's book? And they said, okay, done. And they went to lunch. And he said he got on an airplane, you know, several months later, after the book, you know, when the book first came out, and flew to Pasadena to the BoucherCon convention. This was 1992, I think. I was actually at that conference, too. That was one of my first conferences, the first big ones, the BoucherCon in Pasadena. He said when he got on the airplane from Denver, he said that all of the racks, the paperback racks, had his book. And he said he got off the plane in L.A., all of the paperback racks in the airport had his book.
Oh, my God.
And he said that was the difference. That someone said, let's make White's book lead title, and they printed 450,000 copies.
Oh, my gosh.
And that's how he became a best-selling author.
Wow.
So, so much of this business, being in the right place at the right time, that it's simply a matter of persistence.
And you have to get out there. And I imagine going to these conferences is really important for you, too, as an author.
It is for, you know, just to get your face out there, get your name out there, and become more known among readers. It's the best way to try and, you know, create that word of mouth is just to become known at these conferences. And it's hard to do, too, because it, you know, obviously it requires money and time. And a lot of us don't have a lot of either one, so it can be difficult, too. But, yeah, so they're great fun, and they are important.
Definitely. No, I was wondering about your book, Island Life, and the whole setting with it being somewhat set in suburbia, and whether that was a conscious decision that you're making a statement towards suburbia in general, and then how important setting is for you in your stories.
Suburbia for Island Life was very important. The title speaks directly to it. The book actually takes place on an island, but what I wanted to do was talk symbolically about the fact that we tend to, as people, confine ourselves to that which is most comfortable. And I think suburbia in this country has become kind of synonymous with that, you know, comfortable living, our own comfort zone. I mean, this is the way life should be. I mean, the American dream. You know, we've got a house in the suburbs, and our kids go to nice schools, and our streets are clean and safe at night. This is really where our comfort zone is.
Mm.
And that, for me, was very important, to put this guy in a setting where things like this aren't supposed to happen. People are not supposed to be murdered.
Right.
And you're not supposed to, you know, be a suspect in those murders. I mean, this is, you know, this is the suburbs. This is a safe place. It's also, I think, what I wanted to do was also demonstrate, you know, we are, so much of our lives, we are islands. We isolate ourselves from the outside world. And I wanted to talk a lot about that, too, the fact that we mothers, we need to reach out. We need to not isolate. We're born alone, we die alone, but in between that time, we must create these relationships. Otherwise, spiritually, we wither and die. And I thought that was very important, too, was to get that across, that here's this guy in this very safe setting, and his life is turned upside down because he, you know, because he's allowed himself to kind of, you know, rely on comfort zone.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's got to forge these bridges and bonds with other people, you know, in order to save his own life. And so it was very important to me. And
that's so interesting.
The
idea of suburbia being more of an illusion than reality is what I'm hearing you say.
Well, in a lot of cases it is. It's funny because, when my kids were young, my family lived in Chicago, and before we moved out to the Northwest, my wife at the time and I were also kind of confronting that question of, all right, now that the kids are reaching school age, what do we do? I mean, here we are in inner city Chicago. Gosh, the public school system isn't the best. There are some schools that are good, of course. There are a lot of public in Chicago that are all. So do we, you know, invest in a parochial or a private education, or do we move to the suburbs and pay higher property tax, but, you know, put our kids in public schools and, you know, go to the place where it's safe and comfortable and everybody's like us and so forth. And while we were wrestling with that decision, we were kind of coming down on, boy, you know, we really like this whole experience of being in the city where our kids are exposed to diversity and people of all stripes and colors, economic backgrounds. They understand what it's like to see poor people on the street. They understand what it's like to be friends with black kids and, you know, Puerto Rican kids and you know, which they might not, experiences they might not have in the suburbs. And at the time, we were kind of coming down on that side of, you know, let's stay in the city and, you know, opt for, you know, parochial or private school, probably parochial because that was more affordable. An opportunity to move to the Northwest came up for me, a job opportunity. As I mentioned, my wife at the time was a flight attendant, so she could also, you know, move and still, you know, keep her job because she could even commute if she had to. And we'd heard so much about quality of life in the Northwest, we thought, yeah, let's do it. And when we moved here, we, in essence, moved to the suburbs.
Mm-hmm.
And the place we moved was a very cloistered, very protected, very safe suburban community.
Oh, okay.
And we found ourselves having to constantly remind our children, this is not a reflection of the real world. This is Disneyland. You know, people here, you know, the kids, when they turn 16, they're, you know, their well-to-do parents buy them, you know, BMWs and Mercedes. That's not the real world.
Mm-hmm.
That's not how it works.
Mm-hmm.
And we wanted to continue to reinforce that message because, you know, a couple, our younger ones were going to be too young to really remember their Chicago experience. Fortunately, our older one, you know, did. He remembered a lot of the things that he saw and experienced on the streets of Chicago and the people that he met. And it's very different in the suburbs.
Absolutely. I think that's a really good point. And it, as a parent, I mean, that is to have that kind of consciousness to maintain that understanding with your children. I mean, that is really incredible.
Yeah, and it's important, I think. And I think that's one of the things I tried to get at in Island Life was that whole sense of, you know, when you do that, when you isolate yourself, when you protect yourself, when you build the walls around yourself, you know, to create a comfort zone, you know, you're stepping into dangerous territory because you may become too comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to remind yourself that, you know, where you are is definitely not a reflection of the real world. And that, of course, is what happens to Jack, is that, you know, the real world comes crashing in and he has to deal with it, you know, all of a sudden, and it's very difficult for him. We all kind of have to remember that you know, get too comfortable and your life can be, you know, upset that much more easily.
That's very true. That's an extremely good point. And it sounds to me that with this character and with this story, you were really able to delve into areas within your own experience that you wouldn't be able to actually add to your Emerson Ward series. This is some different issues here.
Right. Exactly right. I mean, which is why, I wanted to take this on. It took me a long time before I was ready to write it because of some of the issues that I did tackle.
Yeah.
I just didn't feel, you know, as a writer, you know, competent enough to deal with them in a way that the reader could understand and, you know, still get a story out of it and still enjoy, you know, without sounding preachy.
Yeah.
So forth.
You did a fantastic job, Michael. It's a great book, wonderful book, Island Life. And just to let listeners know, again, your website is islandlife-thenovel.com. And what can your book be purchased through your website?
People can find links on there to Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com, and those are probably the easiest places to buy it is online. But people are always welcome to walk into their local bookstore and ask, booksellers to order it for them.
Mm-hmm.
It is available through bookstores. It can be ordered, so that's not a problem.
As with all of your books. Great. And I know on your website you have a little movie or a book trailer.
That was a lot of fun to do.
Yeah, those are
to be all the rage. I mean, authors now, you got to have a website, you got to have book trailers, all this modern technology.
Oh, yes, an interesting world we're living in today. Well, I just want to thank you for coming on the program today, Michael. It's been great to finally actually get you on and talk with you. I've known about your work for so long.
Well, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure.
Yeah, and I definitely want to have you back for your next book. It seems like you're basically putting out a book a year almost.
I would love to be able to get to that point. Of course, I can't think that fast.
Yeah.
I'm always saying, boy, I'd love to be able to write as fast.
Yeah, that's true. Do you have time to read with your busy schedule?
I read constantly just because it gives me a lot of both inspiration, and the more I read, the more I am able to kind of analyze how to write a good book.
Mm.
It really has helped my writing.
Are you reading in different genres or basically the one that you write in?
I read basically in the one I write in.
Mm-hmm.
But I try to vary that experience. And I've read some wonderful books recently that are, you know, I mean, totally different from each other. I read the Steve Hawkinsmith, the first one in his series about the Old West.
Oh.
Fabulous, just because it's so original in terms of voice and setting. I read The Janissary Tree about, you know, the guy in old Istanbul. Again, setting, you know, just the historical background of the book, incredible. It takes you places that you normally wouldn't go. And then, of course, you know, traditional kind of modern-day thrillers and mysteries are always great fun. So there's such a wide range of material out there that I never get tired of reading any of it.
No. Do you think you'll ever take a departure from the mystery thriller and go in some completely different direction?
It's possible. As I say, Island Life was originally, I was going to do a mainstream novel, and I think that when I get to the point where I'm comfortable trying something else, I may well do that.
Mm-hmm.
My first book I wrote in college, and it was science fiction, absolutely horrible. But I wrote science fiction. So,
yeah, that's great.
Yeah, it all can be done. But I really am having such a good time with mysteries right now.
Mm-hmm.
Probably stick with this for a while.
Oh, yeah, and readers are loving your book, so there's no reason to really to change that at this point. Well, thank you so much, Michael. It's just been a real pleasure, and I know we'll be talking again.
Oh, terrific.
Take care.
All right, you too.
Bye-bye. All right, listeners, there you go. I've been talking with Michael Shearer. His new novel, Island Life, is out now on Five Star Publishing, can be purchased through local and online booksellers. His website, once again, is islandlife-thenovel.com. And I hope you have enjoyed this interview today. Thank you so much for listening to Inside Scoop Live. I'm Juanita Watson, and until next time.
Blog Talk Radio.